So right. Let's see, where's that script gone? There it is. So yeah, I think we're in business.
We are indeed. Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. Welcome to Crave. This is the podcast dedicated to music and movies and television and theatre and just about anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And that would this week start off with The Good Oil. That would be Midnight Oil, to be precise. Simon and I caught the classic Aussie band's return to New Zealand last night.
What a return it was, Steve. And don't just take our word for it, though. Steve took some fantastic photos of the band in action. Oh, well, you've got to... credits where it's due. So if you want to have a look at those photos from up front, he was right up front of the stage, go to our webpage, cravepodcast.com. But don't do it until you finish listening to this podcast, of course.
Of course, of course, of course.
Yes.
Now, cinematically, there's been an unsettling moment this week, hasn't there? We've been slightly disturbed by the remake of Stephen King's classic It. And interestingly, it wasn't actually Pennywise the Clown that was doing most of the unsettling.
That's what I think too. What's more, Steve, with this one, there's something about the way this film was treated that I think I'm still coming to terms with it and figuring it out, and that's several days on.
Right.
So
right.
I'm not sure I'm going to give you the most succinct answer to your questions in this podcast.
It's going to be a long episode this week, isn't it, Simon?
Never mind. But anyway, there's something else you've seen too, I think.
Yes, I just got in actually from seeing a screening of Victoria and Abdul. This one with Dame Judi Dench once again playing, it's almost like the role she was born to play, isn't it?
yes.
Queen Victoria.
Fantastic.
And that one, well, there's a few things to say there.
And that is, of course, just a snippet from last night's big concert in Auckland. That was Midnight Oil back on our shores. It's been a long time, something like 20 years, apparently. And they seem as fired up as ever. Now, Steve, they are a band I've seen once before, and that's a long time ago. I think it was about 84 by my reckoning. So
wow.
That's what, it's only 33 years ago. But I think for you, this is the first time you saw them live. Is that right?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Right, so I'm going to put. Let's start with you because you've got the sort of the, I was going to say the virgin experience. That's not
yes.
quite the phrase I'm looking for, but you know
yeah.
what I mean.
I do indeed, but they are within me now. And you know, so something that we've talked about on this podcast before is whether or not old men. Let's face it, Peter Garrett is 64 years old, and he's an ex cabinet minister. So let's face it, yeah, you know, how good's that show ever going to be? And yet at the same time. I on my car on the way to Spark Arena last night, I was listening to Diesel and Dust and being astonished by just what an amazingly powerful album it is. And I was trying to figure out, you know, men of this age, can they still do it?
Hmm.
And I think the answer has to be an absolutely unequivocal yes.
And I agree. I think so too. I as I say, I saw them by my count 33 years ago. And there's a couple of things I still remember from that concert, which was in Auckland. all that time ago was, first of all, how I have this memory of how loud the band were and how much my ears were ringing afterwards.
Okay.
And I have that image in my mind, and it's just what we saw last night, Steve, of Peter Garrett bestriding the stage in that sort of angular strutting movements that he uses.
Oh, yes.
Arms outstretched, massive hands. I don't know how tall he is. He's 6'6" or something. And that image was quite a stark and strong image, and it stayed with me for all these years. That was fantastic to see him back looking, I have to say, pretty much as lean as ever. And his voice was pretty damn good, I thought.
Well, let's face it. I mean, ultimately, excuse me, I know we shouldn't identify bands solely with their singers.
No.
But in many cases, the singer will be one of the most identifiable parts of a band. And let's face it, with Midnight Oil, you've got a singular voice. And, I mean, how would you even describe it? A howl?
Yeah, he's got a very it's a very interesting voice, because it's strong, but it's not that sort of raspy classic rock voice, hard rock voice, is it? It's something else that he sang full on for a couple of hours there, and really he was going pretty well right through to the end. And it's that combination of that voice and that just his physical presence on stage.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever seen him, but he's got a sort of a staccato strutting sort of style in part, and then occasionally he lapses into something that almost looks like a Pacific fluid sort of maybe it was Australian indigenous influence there or something. I'm not quite sure how to describe it.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, yeah. So he's really a very strong presence on stage. But I thought what was interesting, he dominated, but he would give room for his band mates. And they are a pretty impressive bunch of musicians. And the thing I thought as I was watching that, a very, very strong and committed show, Steve, was that it's a great example, isn't it, of guys who, I guess, played together a long time. They are musically very together and very tight, but it doesn't feel over practiced or just as if they're going through the motions. It feels like that they are in the moment, which allows you to be in the moment.
There was fire, there was passion on stage last night.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a particular round of applause has to go to Rob Hurst, the band's drummer.
Yes.
Dear
fantastic.
Lord, I mean, he must have been knackered at the end of that.
And it's worth mentioning that I quite like, they did it in the middle section of the concert. They did a sort of almost a semi-acoustic set.
Yes.
And they all gathered quite close together at the front of stage. And as you say, the drummer Hurst, he joined them at the front standing, playing with drumsticks, but almost like it looked like a very small little drum kit, almost like a...
It looked like a
bongo kit.
From as far as I could tell, it was a snare drum perched on top of an upended bass drum that he was playing with a pedal, and then a single cymbal. And he was leathering the hell out of that thing.
He sure was. There was a very, very good solo towards the end during the Power and the Passion.
Yes.
Where they had a bit of corrugated iron there at the back of the stage, made up to look like a water tank or something. And
yes.
He played on that as well. And that was really, really effective and memorable.
In fact, you mentioned that the acoustic, but yeah, that when they played Lyric Your Way and when the Generals Talk, I noticed the entire band were acoustic, even down to, oh, he has to get mentioned, obviously, Bones Hillman, the Kiwi bass player.
Playing
an acoustic bass.
Yes. So and I think there's something about that, wasn't it? They were standing quite close together. It was just that sort of that classic brothers in arms sort of feel of it. And the other thing that struck me, song after song, was yes, Garrett is taking the lead with the vocals, but they all sing pretty well. And when they're singing together, it's a pretty strong, powerful sound. Their voices, I'm talking about. So no, it was a really strong concert. I guess we can't not mention the politics here, Steve, can we? Because this is a band that has absolutely built its reputation and its career, not just on some great songs, but on just the whole place they occupy in the politics of this part of the world.
Well, when
environmental,
was the when have you ever heard a singer at somewhere like Spark Arena say to the audience, you know, when I was an MP,
yeah,
these are not words you expect to hear from a rock singer, are they? And yet he pulls it off.
He does. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. And he wasn't scared about it. He wasn't shy. He was quite upfront about it. And it was both nodding back to their own history and some of the causes they fought for in the past. He mentioned the Rainbow Warrior bombing in Auckland way back in the 80s. But of course, he had to reference the most recent tour, that this is part of the Great Circle Tour. And he talked about being in the States, and Donald Trump mentioned more than once, and visually very strongly in his You're Fired Trump t-shirt that Pete Garrett was wearing. So that whole sense of, you wouldn't have come to the show, you wouldn't have come to the show and not expected them to say something about social or political or environmental issues, and they certainly didn't let us down in that regard.
Well, I don't think they've recorded a single song that doesn't have a very clear, very explicit political agenda. That's who they are.
That is, yeah. The other thing was the whole ANZAC bond, Steve, which was, I thought he, I think he did pretty well there. He started off with Kia Ora New Zealand, didn't he? And then he had to reference that song Shipyards of New Zealand. He mentioned occasionally.
Which, incidentally, I don't think they've been playing on most nights on this tour.
No, funny that, yes.
But they had to pull it out last night. And I was down the in the photo pit when they played that. Right. And I heard the roar behind me, and I could see there's a smile on his face. He knew what he was doing. The first time he said the words New Zealand, and he knew.
Yes. And then later on, or it might have been earlier, he talked about some of the small towns they'd visited in previous tours.
Yes.
And then, of course, I'm skipping ahead a little bit here to the encore. Was that
yes,
when they
yes,
mentioned
I know where you're
the
going with
the band?
This.
And there was a wonderful surprise that I think, I guess when we thought about it, it wasn't that surprising, but they did a cover. I don't know how often they do covers, but a wonderful New Zealand pop song called Counting the Beat, recorded way back in the 80s by a band called The Swingers. And that band had one Bones Hillman as its bass player, who is now in Midnight Oil, so the Kiwi. So that was a nice tying thing.
You had a nice chortle at that one, didn't you? I saw
I did. I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the bottom line is, you know, 64 years old for Garrett, and the others are comparable age, obviously.
Yes, yes.
And you'd never have guessed it, would you?
No, you really wouldn't. They played fantastically well with a lot of energy, a lot of heart. I mean, if they were going through the motions, boy, they hit it well, because it sure didn't look like it. It looked like they were totally enjoying what they were doing. And I thought they structured the song, the set list, pretty well, building up to the end of that first set, Steve, and then they left the real strong, heavy-hitting, big hits, 1, 2, 3, 4, right at the end there, and that really got the crowd absolutely
They've got no new material to tour. They're not promoting a new album. See, the set list's on the website in our little photo gallery. So the songs you're referencing here, I mean, how far back do you go to talk about, you know, the incredible ending? But the five they close with, or even the sixth,
yes,
it closes with Warakurna, Power and Passion, Dead Heart, Beds Are Burning, Blue Sky, and Forgotten Years.
Yeah.
Now, you can't beat an ending like that, can you?
No, that was really, really strong. It really, it was fantastic. It was really good.
Even though, like we're saying, you know, it's like old people doing old people music. And before I left, my daughter, who's 19, was saying, oh, you're going to do another old man band, aren't you? And I'll tell you what, there was more energy in that show than anything she ever goes to watch. I was astonished. And everybody in the audience, we were in the seats at the side, and we could see the entire floor of Spark Arena completely packed and heaving.
Yes, no, I think there'd be a very rare occurrence to have anyone leaving that show not being satisfied and not feeling that they really got their money's worth. It was a great, really good show, one of the best I've seen in ages, and big ups to those Aussies, that's what I say.
And it's not often a Kiwi says that. Now, I just have to mention in passing one off note.
Yes,
actually, quite literally an off note.
Right.
Peter Garrett pulled out his harmonica twice.
Right.
He played Blue Sky Mine, which we're going to have a video of on the webpage on our cravepodcast.com website for this particular episode. There'll be a YouTube video of Blue Sky Mine, which was fantastic. But then earlier on, when they played Truganinny and he pulled out his harmonica.
Yeah.
And it was almost like it was the first time he'd ever handled one.
Oh, okay.
It's a song that I know fairly well. It's one of the better songs from Earth and Sun and Moon. And right. And I saw it on the set. I was, oh, great, they're playing True Canadians. It's going to be good. Pulled out his harmonica, and I'm thinking, I could do better than that.
Oh, okay.
I really wondered what was going wrong there. I didn't get a chance to record it because I was shooting at the time. But
it was
odd. So just I mentioned that in passing.
Okay.
Otherwise,
yes,
an utterly outstanding show.
It was. I know they're playing in Christchurch. We're recording this on the Sunday after the Saturday show in Auckland. I think they're playing tomorrow night, Monday, in Christchurch. If there's a chance to see them, you really should grab it. It'll be a great show.
Couldn't agree more.
Serve your king, know your custom, don't speak your tongue. White man came to everyone. But don't serve your country, don't serve your king. White man, listen to the songs we sing. White man came to everything.
So Peter Garrett of Midnight Oil keeps his commentary very much in the here and now of world events. But you might find that you want to escape from all the natural disasters, the political disasters of recent times. As we record this, my family and friends are evacuating from Florida.
As soon as
I hang the microphone upside, but I'm going to go and check and make sure that the my people in Florida are still alive. It's not a given at this stage. So
no, we shouldn't joke about it. It sounds terrible over there. Well, but anyway.
This is why we left.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, one of the many reasons.
Anyway, if you did want to escape all that sort of mayhem.
If you need escapism, and quite frankly, for those of you listening in Florida, you're probably going to want to. So you might want to get yourself to the pictures.
Yes.
And see an old-fashioned trip to a horror movie is going to take your mind off things.
Yeah, normally that would be the case. And the one that Steve and I have seen this week, it's just opening around the world, I think, is the latest cinematic version of the Stephen King story, It. Now, Steve, fair to say that most horror movies, the huge proportion of them are horribly formulaic. And this one, I guess, in many ways is. There are some very familiar aspects to the story, but there really was more going on here than that. There really was as you mentioned in the intro, Steve, a kind of an unsettling and a disturbing, even at times quite a nasty edge to what we were seeing in what appeared to be a classic sort of, you know, young kids banding together against the evil horror type story. Is that how you – I certainly felt that, and I felt it more as the days have gone by and this film has been percolating in my mind. What about you?
It is a percolator, isn't it? It's a bit of a slow burn of a film.
Yeah.
You don't want to rush your opinions of it. But it occurred to me that the film breaks down into two very conveniently separable halves, really. Mm-hmm. And so, the basic story, if we're not familiar with it, is – there is a presence, an evil presence in the town of Derry in Maine, that keeps taking children. And so the film starts with young Georgie being taken in the sewers by a scary clown called Pennywise.
Yes.
Fair enough. And so the first half of the film is Georgie's older brother Bill and three of his mates who are trying to make sense of what happened and trying to figure out what's going wrong all the while. Because they're sort of like, you know, typically slightly dorky, nerdy kids, such as Stephen King depicts beautifully in his books. And they call themselves the Losers Club, and they try and make sense of what's going on. They find themselves being joined by a couple of other losers, one of whom is an amateur historian who's pieced together an analysis of what's going on in Derry, one of whom is a young girl who is desperate for some kind of home in the town.
Yes.
Who joins the Losers Club, as they call themselves, for companionship. So that's the first half of the film. And that film was brilliant.
Yes.
So you've got a bunch of kids who are banding together and they're surrounded by evil.
Yes. And they are... I know what you're saying with this, Steve. You're not talking necessarily at all about the evil of Pennywise, which is an evil that confronts the whole town. But we're given a little bit of backstory on all these kids, aren't we?
Yes.
And we see a little bit of their home lives. So not all of them, but most of them, as you say, they form this self-proclaimed losers club. And there's a reason for that. Bill, the one who's lost his young brother, Georgie, he's a stutterer. Ben, who's that amateur historian you talked about, he's an overweight little kid, and he doesn't engage socially with anyone else. You've got Richie, the short-sighted one, big, thick glasses, who's got the dirty mind and the dirty mouth of a much older teenager. You've got young Eddie, who's the hypochondriac. Stanley, the young Jewish boy, very straight-laced. And then, as you mentioned, the other two, there was also a young little black boy called Mike, who was bullied because of his skin color, who joined the group. And then, as you say, Beverly, who was also bullied and verbally abused. And let's not to put too fine a point on it, Steve, because many people around the town in her age group accused her of being a slut. So, but more than that, some of the adults in the world of these kids gave this film, let's talk about Beverly. Her father, that was one of the most ickiest depictions of a father-daughter relationship I've ever seen, I think.
He was still my special little girl.
Oh, it was awful, wasn't it?
Lizardly, reptilian.
Yeah. Even some of the others maybe weren't quite to that level, but even Eddie's mother was, feeding his hypochondria. Stanley, this Jewish boy, clearly was a very strict father, overbearing, sort of forcing him to do things he didn't really want to do. The little black boy, Mike, was it his father or grandfather who was forcing him to take part in the slaughter of sheep in the barn? I mean, there was an oppressive, awful at times aspect to the stories of all these kids.
Works, if you think about it, on a couple of levels. There was also older kids who were, bullying doesn't begin to describe.
No,
they were tormenting and torturing these lads. But even the lead bully's father was himself a bully to the teenage bully. So we've got layer upon layer of innocent youth being tormented by sinister, foul, dreadful age.
Yeah, even a very short little scene involving the town chemist or pharmacist was quite unpleasant as well. As time's gone by, Steve, I find those aspects and those characters, I'm just trying to get to grips with what the, and I haven't read the Stephen King's books. I don't know, have you yourself? Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
So I'm not quite sure if that was there in the book and whether this is just a faithful adaptation of that, or the filmmakers have sort of added a little twist here. But it gives the whole thing, it takes it away from being just a typical bunch of kids, banding together to fight the evil force. It's more unsettling than that.
It is, isn't it? And that's really effective. Because, in my opinion at least, the director, whose name I was going to look up very quickly, Andy Muschietti, that's right.
Yes.
I thought the way he pulled the kids together was beautiful. He did a very, very good job of depicting them with absolute sympathy. They were innocent. They were charming. I mean, you mentioned... the one lad, particularly Richie, who is desperately trying to be the filthy potty mouth wisecracker, and even though his humor is foul, you can't be offended by it because there's so much innocence in it that he's just nothing but endearing. So the entire thing is being depicted with nothing but sympathy and support for these children.
Yes,
and basically, I think. He was trying to remake Stand By Me at this stage. And and on that level, it worked.
Yes, I just want to very quickly mention before we go on to the next bit, I thought there was a really nicely played little love triangle within the group where the overweight kid, Ben, who was finding a lovely relationship with Beverly, but Beverly really was kind of keener on the stutterer Bill, and I thought they played that very nicely. And Ben, the overweight kid Ben, I thought he had a lovely touch to his performance. It looked like a much older kid trying to get across a lost love or unrequited love, I guess. I thought that was really a lovely little touch.
Yeah, this is Jeremy Ray Taylor playing Ben, yes. who again, as all the lads in this did, and the girls as well, had a richness to their performances. Sophia Lillis as Beverly, the girl in question, she's got great things ahead of her. She was fantastic.
Yes. Now, we were talking about how old she was, because most of the boys seemed like, well, what, 11, 10, 11, 12, something around about there?
I'd put them around 12-ish, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, well, I think the actress who plays Beverly, Sophia, is 15.
Oh, okay,
apparently. So there's. Yeah. I thought we thought that there was a little more maturity to her performance, and that's why,
obviously girls being that much more mature than boys in general.
Anyway, so we haven't been talking about Pennywise much here, have we? So
it's funny, that, isn't it?
Yes, perhaps we should move on to that.
So what did you make of Pennywise then, Simon?
Well, I thought I saw the trailer, and I thought the trailer looked quite genuinely scary, and there were some quite good tense frights in it. But I found myself so drawn into the kids. I didn't care so much about Pennywise, really. I mean, they're the usual good standard of special effects and, you know, awful creatures and that you'd expect in a film like this these days. But I don't know. I was just the personal story of how these kids got together and banded together was so affecting and drew me in much more than what the fact that I didn't really know that much about Pennywise's backstory, for example. I should have cared about that, but I didn't.
But that, to be fair, is classic Stephen King. Is evil just exists, and I think in his mind, evil just is. You don't need to explain where it comes from. Okay. I mean, we know his mind is a terrifying place, and yeah. I think you'll see this in a lot of the books he's writing in that era. You know, things like Needful Things or the Tommyknockers or books like that. You just have evil. It just is. There's no reason. You don't need to justify to explain it. There is no backstory necessary because, well, you know, evil is, isn't it?
Right.
So it's just there. But no, they didn't really explain where he came from. They didn't really explain anything about what it was. And so as a result, you didn't really know how the children could attempt to destroy it. And so you couldn't really know during the big climactic sequence, well, have they killed him yet? Well, they might do. I don't know what killing him involves. So you didn't really know what was going on.
But that's true.
But
I thought there were there is a very well visually a very strong sequence at the end there where we get a sense of what's happened to some of the other children who've gone missing, and that's presented in a very Dante sort of like way, I suppose. It was a very strong image. But it I don't want to give too many spoilers away here, but there were left a couple of questions there about what had happened to one of the other key characters in the story, maybe won't go into. But so a couple of loose ends there that I didn't quite feel were explained very well. But as you say, Steve, maybe that's Stephen King doesn't really care about that so much. And maybe the filmmakers were just being faithful to how he told the story.
Possibly. But the other thing that does work in a book, and I'm going to give credit to our guest reviewer, Debbie, for this particular insight, because she was the one who pointed this out to me. Is as long as you're imagining the evil and the horror, and as long as it's happening in the shadows, and as long as you don't know what it is, it's terrifying. As long as there's hints of Pennywise, as long as he's just his face half formed in the gutter and a voice in the distance, it's terrifying. The moment Bill Skarsgård in a clown outfit stands in front of you, oh, that's all he is. Fair enough. Not scary anymore.
No, correct. That's true.
And to be fair, there were plenty of good jump scares. I mean, I heard you laughing nervously after quite a few of them.
Yes, fair enough. But, you got me.
But when the moment you confront someone's face on, that's it. You demystify it.
Yes.
When you're still terrified of what it's going to be, then the tension ramps up, and that was part of the sinister nature of the parents and the adults. You never quite knew what they were capable of. You didn't quite know where they were going to take these children. But Pennywise is just a scary clown, isn't he? We can move on from that.
Yes, I agree. So to come back to the point we started this discussion with, I reckon it was those adults, and that whatever whatever lay behind their unfortunate and twisted characters that their children suffered, whatever was going on there was as disturbing and as horrific as Pennywise was.
Absolutely.
Just one other quick thing we must mention. We haven't mentioned the humor. There's actually quite a good smattering of humor all the way through, delivered with the kids.
Yes.
And particularly the foul-mouthed Richie, as you said. And it was quite nicely timed and some welcome relief and some genuine laughs. There's a lot of people laughing in the audience. And they did that quite well, I thought.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, you don't usually turn to Stephen King for comedy. and I don't really think that's necessarily what we were looking for here. But you've got a screenplay written by, among other people, Cary Fukunaga, who was responsible for things like True Detective.
So
you've got a strong script writing team.
Yes.
The other two, Chase Palmer and Gary Doberman. I don't know so much about Gary Doberman's got a decent track record writing basic horror.
Yeah.
Things like Annabelle Creation, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, you have got good source material, and certainly in Fukunaga, you've got a really strong writer. So I think that probably underpins that.
Yeah.
So yeah, look, we're talking around this, aren't we? Let's just cut to the chase. Yes. Does one buy a ticket for this?
Well, I find this, with most films, I find it pretty easy to say yes or no. And this one I'm actually struggling a bit with, because I think it kind of depends what you're going in for. It actually becomes quite a disturbing horror story within the framework of what looks like a very traditional middle America, you know, small town, young kids type story. There's this darker edge to it, which is quite unsettling. You've almost got to be ready for that, because I can imagine some people finding that a little distasteful and affecting their view of the film. I'm glad I saw it. It's given me a lot to think about. I guess I would recommend it. If you're into the horror movies, I think it is worth seeing. And if you're a Stephen King fan, of course you would. And it's certainly a well produced and it looks a good horror movie. And it just gives you something a little bit more to think about. What's going on in the minds of the person who came up with a story? It doesn't answer all the questions, which makes maybe that's a good thing. And so I'm going to say yes with that little qualification of just be a little bit prepared for what you're going to watch.
I think that's a pretty fair summation. I mean, one thing I do know is we might get some of the questions you were mentioning answered when part two comes out.
Yeah.
Because okay. I'm reading that it's made somewhere in the order of $100 million in the US in its opening weekend. And if you remember at the very end, the closing title says It, Chapter 1.
Yes, it does. That's right.
And the novel has two intertwining timelines of the children as children and then the children as adults. And if it's making $100 million on the first episode, I think it's fair to say we'll be getting a second.
I think that's an excellent prediction.
I stake what little is left of my reputation on it.
Yeah, righto. Okay, so I think that's a yes from both of us. Right, now there's another film,
yes.
Steve, that you, in fact, you're so recently returned from seeing this film, I think back in the theatre that your seat is still warm.
More than likely.
Yes, this is a far cry from It. This is more the Rialto end of the market. Would that be fair?
It is, yes. It's definitely the other end of the spectrum. We were talking about Victoria and Abdul. I so want to say Victoria and Albert. It's an unfortunate title. And it's an interesting film. It really is. It tells the apparently true story of Queen Victoria, obviously, and a chap named Abdul Karim, who was simply an Indian servant who was fetched up to Balmoral just to do a bit of bowing and scraping and to do one little ceremony where he presents the Queen with a particular medal during the middle of a banquet. Because he's a bit of all right, she takes a look at him and takes a bit of a shine to him and says, that one there, he's a bit tall and good looking, fetch him over to be my personal servant.
As you do.
And she's 80 odd years old at this stage, but she's still got an eye for the fellas, clearly. And so he then works as her servant and they strike up a friendship.
Right.
And she has him teaching her Urdu. And one word that she learns is Munshi, which means teacher or mentor. And so he becomes the Munshi. And that's how she refers to him. He, you know, I want to see the Munshi, bring the Munshi to me. And he becomes very, very much in her good graces. And obviously, this won't do. Because, well, you know, he's one of those, isn't he? He's a Hindustani. He's an Indian. Even worse, he's a Muslim. God for God's sake, and it wouldn't do possibly for one of those to have any kind of influence with the Empress of India. And right. So you've got an amazing supporting cast. You've got people like Michael Gambon as Lord Salisbury, the Prime Minister. Yeah. You've got Tim Pigott-Smith as a retainer. You've got Olivia Williams as Baroness Churchill. And most brilliantly of all, you've got Eddie Izzard.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Who is fantastic as Bertie, the Prince of Wales. He's utterly superb.
Okay.
And they all despise him. And they do everything in their power to undermine him. And in the meantime, you've got Abdul, played by Ali Fazal, who's not a name I recognised. But he's absolutely brilliant. He's got this really warm sort of sparkle, even though he knows that everyone around him has got daggers ready to plunge into his back.
Yeah.
He is forming a genuine affection, even though he knows he's just a servant and he can be cast aside at any moment. And she does try to once or twice. He knows his place, but he also knows that there is a genuine affection between the two. And so you see her trying to defend him as all around just simply wants, you know, they have him sent back where he belongs as soon as possible. And it's a sweet story. It's a true story. There's no way in the world this film would have been made were it not a true story. But it's sweet. It's genuinely funny. It's slow. It's quietly nice. And it's worth a look. Eddie Izzard makes the film.
Yeah.
Michael Gambon can do no wrong. Judi Dench is Judi Dench. I mean, she never really fully gets into gear, but it's possible that, you know, that's the character she was playing. But, you know, she feels a little bit restrained. And in the end, it's not bad.
Okay. Thank you. Just before you said it was a true story, a rather cynical thought crossed my mind.
What's that?
Which was this an attempt by modern British filmmakers to somehow assuage any colonial guilt and sort of portray a story which showed a degree more liberalness in the views of the day back then? But clearly, by what you're telling me, that those around Queen Victoria were very much entrenched in their racism and their sense of the class system and the racial system, and so the film doesn't shy away from that at all.
No, they clearly despised him. In fact, at some point when he, certainly for the first half of the film, where he's clearly being mocked by the retinue and the retainers and all the rest, it's hard even to figure out where the film's sympathies lie. So we're almost being encouraged to laugh and to sneer at him with the white people. It's only as the film develops you start to realise that he is being presented as a very sympathetic character for whom we should have sympathy. It's kind of odd the way that the directorial sympathies lie, but you know what? Set that aside and go and enjoy it. It's a story that kind of needed telling, really. To be fair, it's not one that many people know. Apparently, after Victoria died, Bertie, as he became, what would he have been, Edward the Seventh?
Yes,
had him basically expunged from history.
Oh, really? Okay.
He despised and deplored him, and it wasn't until his apparently his journals came to light in 2010.
Oh,
yeah, it was very, very recent that we even knew about him.
Isn't that amazing? So the filmmakers are doing us all a favour here by at least bringing to the pub wider public a story that we should know about. Okay, cool, very good. Steve, we've had a busy couple of weeks here, but I'm just thinking of other big films, big concerts coming up. I know obviously we can always go to our web page, our website, cravepodcast.com, to get a really good rundown of events coming up. But anything you want to mention just at the moment?
Well, there's been a couple of announcements. I don't know if you're a big Drake fan. I'm not.
Sir Francis?
No, just Drake. just Drake, who will be coming to Auckland on the 3rd of November.
Right,
not entirely our thing. More toward the sort of the R&B end of the spectrum. More hardcore rock. We've got the Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
We'll be here in January and February. They're going to be playing Mount Smart Stadium. Roger Waters has announced a second date for Auckland. And now contain your excitement. And I know this is going to just like...
I can't. Control
yourself, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Niall Horan. Contain yourself, Simon.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay. Shall I Google him?
I know life's not been worth living for you since One Direction split up.
Oh, I see. Of course. Yeah. No. Beside myself with misery, I am.
To the extent that you can't even bring yourself to think of his name any longer, can you? But he is going to be playing in June. So we're planning way ahead here. June.
Yes.
The first Friday, he's coming to Spark Arena.
Oh, gosh. I think that might be one for Debbie to review for us, too.
I have a feeling we might just have to delegate that one, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Yes.
And she's going to tell us it's a great show.
Oh, I can write the review already.
Okay. Well, that's quite a bit to look forward to, depending on your tastes.
Absolutely.
all right. Hey, good stuff. So I think we should toddle along. Just a reminder that... please check out our web page, cravepodcast.com, because Steve has got a really nice gallery of photographs from last night's Auckland concert given to us by Midnight Oil. So that's really nice to see that there. I've got a little trip away for 2 or 3 weeks, so a slightly longer gap probably between now and our next podcast, but I'm sure we'll be back with all guns blazing. I shouldn't use that sort of metaphor, really. But
packed program.
It'll be a packed program. So in the meantime, I know we get a few comments and likes on our Facebook page, which is always nice. But if you want to get in touch with us by the traditional means of email, we're always pleased to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can indeed. And you can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
There you go. So, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Excellent.
Good job. Whoops.